Hi. In the years since I wrote The Precipice, the question that I'm asked most is how the risks have changed. It's now almost 4 years since the book came out, but the text has to be locked down a long time before that. And so we're really coming up to something like 5 years of changes to the risk landscape. I'm going to dive into four of the biggest risks, climate change, nuclear, pandemics, and AI, to show how they've changed. Now, a lot has happened over the years, and I don't want this to just be a recapping of the news in fast forward. But luckily, for each of these risks, I think there are some key insights and takeaways that one can distill from everything that's happened. So I'm going to take you through them and tease out these key updates and why they matter. I'm going to focus on changes to the landscape of existential risk. So that includes human extinction and other ways that humanity's entire potential could be permanently lost. For most of these areas, there are many other serious risks and ongoing harms that have also changed, but I won't be able to get into those. The point of this talk is to really narrow in on the changes to existential risk. So let's start with climate change. We can estimate the potential damages from climate change in three broad steps. First, there's how much carbon will we ultimately emit? Then, how much warming will this carbon produce? And finally, how much damage does that warming do? And there have been key updates to the first two of these steps, which have mostly flown under the radar for the general public. I think for one of them, it may not have appeared on the nightly news at all. So the question of how much carbon we will emit is often put in terms of representative concentration pathways, RCPs. You might remember seeing these over the last decade or so. Initially, there were four of these RCPs. With higher numbers, meaning more greenhouse effect in the year 2100. They're all somewhat arbitrarily chosen. They're meant to represent broad possibilities for how our emissions might unfold over the century. Our lack of knowledge about which path we will take was a huge source of uncertainty about how bad climate change would ultimately be. Many of the more dire climate predictions are based on the worst of these paths, RCP 8.5. And it's now clear that we're not at all on RCP 8.5. And in fact, people who are still using it to make projections in the news are starting to get some pretty severe criticism for doing so. And instead, our own path is currently headed somewhere between the lower of these two paths here. The green and the blue. This isn't great news. Many people were hoping that we could control our emissions faster than this. But for the purposes of existential risk from climate change, much of the risk comes from the worst case possibilities. So even just moving towards the middle of the range of possible outcomes means lower existential risk. And the lower part of the middle is even better. Now, what about the second question of how much warming that carbon will produce? The key measure here is something called equilibrium climate sensitivity. This is roughly defined as how many degrees of warming there would be if the concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere were to double from the pre-industrial levels. If there were no climate feedbacks, this would be quite easy to estimate. Doubling carbon dioxide while keeping everything else fixed produces about 1.2 degrees Celsius of warming. But the climate sensitivity also accounts for many different climate feedbacks, though not all of them. It includes water, vapor, and cloud formation, which have been particularly tricky to nail down. And these make it harder to estimate and also higher. When I wrote The Precipice, the IPCC stated that climate sensitivity was likely to be somewhere between 1.5 degrees, and 4.5 degrees. In the first of these lines over here. When it comes to estimating the impacts of warming, this is a vast range. with the top of the range giving three times as much warming as the bottom of the range. Moreover, the true sensitivity could be even higher, as the IPCC was only saying that there was a two-thirds chance that it even falls into this range at all. So there was something like a 1 in 6 chance that climate sensitivity would be even higher than 4.5 degrees. And that's where a lot of the existential risk from climate is coming from. It's coming from these possibilities of extreme warming, even if they're less likely than the mainline scenarios. Scenarios where climate is more responsive to emissions than we expected. To understand the existential risk from climate, we really want to find out where in this vast range the real climate sensitivity lies. But there has been markedly little progress on this. The range from 1.5 degrees to 4.5 degrees was first proposed the year I was born, 1979, has not appreciably changed in the 40 years following that until The Precipice came out. That's quite remarkable. It's not just that that best estimate stayed the same because it was correct, but even the range around the best estimate didn't change. You'd be expecting it to narrow in if that was a correct estimate. But now it has. So in the latest assessment report, the IPCC has narrowed the likely range. In this case, it's represented in the dark blue. Has narrowed this likely range, the 66% confidence window, to span from 2.5 degrees to 4 degrees, reflecting an improved understanding of these climate feedbacks and also a better Bayesian understanding of how to collate all the different sources of evidence that were bearing on this. Now, this is a mixed blessing, as it's saying that very good and very bad outcomes are both less likely to happen. But again, reducing the possibility of extreme warming will ultimately lower the existential risk that we're focusing on here. And they also narrowed their 90% confidence range, which they'd introduced in the last two reports, with them now saying that it's 95% likely that the climate sensitivity is less than 5 degrees. So this is ultimately very good news if you're worried about extreme climate change scenarios. In both cases here, these updates were about narrowing the range of plausible possibilities, which has the effect of reducing the chance of extreme outcomes, which reduces the existential risk. But there's an interesting difference, actually, between these two. When considering our emissions, it was humanity's actions in responding to the threat of climate change which have lowered our emissions from what they would have been with business as usual. Our actions lowered the risk. In contrast, in the case of climate sensitivity, the change in the risk is not causal, but evidential. We've discovered evidence that the temperature won't be as sensitive to our emissions as we previously thought it might be. We'll see this for some of the other risks too. Sometimes we've made the risk lower or higher, and sometimes we've just discovered that they always were that way. Okay, nuclear. At the time of writing The Precipice, the idea of nuclear war had seemed like a forgotten menace. Cast your mind back. Something that I had to remind people still existed. Here's what I said in The Precipice about the possibility of great power war when I was trying to make the case that it could still happen. Consider the prospect of great power war this century, that is, war between any of the world's most powerful countries or blocs. War on such a scale defined the first half of the 20th century, and its looming threat defined much of the second half too. Even though international tension may again be growing, it seems almost unthinkable that any of the great powers will go to war with each other this decade, and unlikely for the foreseeable future. But a century is a long time, and there is certainly a risk that a great power war will break out once more. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has brought nuclear powers substantially closer to the brink of war and nuclear war. Remember all the calls for a no-fly zone in Ukraine, with the implicit threat that if it was violated, the US and Russia would immediately end up in a shooting war in the Ukraine. Or the heightened rhetoric from both the US and Russia about the devastating capabilities of their nuclear weapons and the nuclear retaliation that would be visited upon the other side, and also of their actions to increase the readiness of their nuclear forces. Now, this isn't a Cuban Missile Crisis level, but the tension has also subsided from the peak. But the situation is still markedly worse than anyone anticipated when I was writing The Precipice. When I wrote The Precipice, the major nuclear treaty between the US and Russia, called New START, was due to lapse, and President Donald Trump intended to let that happen. However, it was re-signed at the last minute by the incoming Biden administration. But it can't be renewed again. It's due to expire exactly 2 years from now. And a new replacement treaty would have to be negotiated at a time when the two countries have a terrible relationship and are actively engaged in a proxy war. In The Precipice, I talked about the history of nuclear warhead stockpiles decreasing ever since 1986, and I showed this familiar graph. We'd been getting used to that curve of nuclear warheads going ever downwards, with the challenge being, how do we get it to go down faster? How do we finally get it down to zero? But now there's a looming possibility of stockpiles increasing. Indeed, I think that that's the most likely possibility. In some ways, this could be an even more important time for the nuclear risk community, as their actions may make the difference between a dramatic rise and a mild rise, or between a mild rise and stability. But it is a sad time. In The Precipice, one reason I didn't rate the existential risk from nuclear war higher than I did was that our current arsenals, nuclear arsenals in the world, there isn't a known scientific pathway for an all-out war to lead to human extinction. I think very plausibly it could lead to a nuclear winter, but that is more likely to lead to a collapse of civilization from which we may well be able to recover than to nuclear extinction. And none of the scientists actively working in that area think that extinction is a particularly plausible possibility. But now the arsenals are going to rise, perhaps a long way, and that could change things. Meanwhile, there has been a collapse in funding for work on nuclear peace and arms reduction, work that, among other things, helped to convince the US government to create the New START Treaty in the first place. The MacArthur Foundation had been a major donor in this space, contributing about 45% of all funding. But it pulled out of funding this work, leading to a massive collapse in funding for the field, with nuclear experts having to seek out other careers, and the community losing this talent and expertise that had been built up over time, even while their help was more needed than at any time in the last few decades. Now, each of these changes, I think, is a big deal. A Russian invasion of a European country leading to a proxy war with the US, the only remaining arms control treaty due to expire, allowing a new nuclear arms race, while the civil society actors working to limit these risks see their funding halve. So nuclear risk is up. Pandemics. Since I wrote the book, we had the biggest pandemic in 100 years. It started in late 2019 when my text was already locked in, and then it hit the UK and the US in full force, just as the book was released in March. Now, COVID was not an existential risk, but it did have implications for such risks. First, it exposed serious weakness in our ability to defend against such risks. One of the big challenges of existential risk is that it is speculative. When I wrote in The Precipice that if there was a clear and present danger, like an asteroid visibly on a collision course with the Earth, that then things would move into action. Humanity would be able to unite behind a common enemy, pushing our national or factional squabbles into the background. Well, there was some of that, at first. But as the crisis dragged on, we saw it become increasingly polarized along existing national and political lines. So one lesson here is that the uniting around a common threat is a temporary phase. You get a few months of that, and you need to use them well before the polarization kicks in. Another kind of weakness that the pandemic exposed was in our institutions for managing these risks. I entered the pandemic holding the WHO and the CDC in very high regard, which I really didn't think that they lived up to. One hypothesis I've heard for this is that they did have the skills to manage such crises a generation ago, but decades without needing to prove those skills led them to atrophy. A second implication of COVID is that the pandemic acted as a warning shot for humanity. The idea that humanity might experience large, sweeping catastrophes that change our way of life was almost unthinkable in 2019. But it is now much more believable. This is true both on a personal level and a civilizational level. We can now imagine going through a new event where our day-to-day life is completely upended for years on end. And we can imagine events that sweep the globe and threaten civilization itself. Our air of invincibility has been punctured. That said, it produced less of an immune response than was expected. The conventional wisdom is that a crisis like this leads to a panic-neglect cycle, where we oversupply caution for a while, but we can't keep it up. And this was the expectation of many people in the biosecurity community, with their main strategy being about making sure that the response wasn't too narrowly focused on a rerun of COVID, but instead that it covered a wide range of possible pandemics, and that the funding was ring-fenced so that it couldn't be funneled away to other issues when the memory of this tragedy began to fade. But we didn't even see a panic stage. Spending on biodefense for future pandemics was disappointingly weak in the UK and even worse in the US. I don't know about other countries' responses. A third implication was the amazing improvement in vaccine development times. There's some good news, including the successful first ever deployment of a mRNA vaccine. When I wrote The Precipice, the typical time from vaccine development was decades, and the fastest ever time was 10 years. The expert consensus was that it would take at least a couple of years for COVID. But instead, we had several completely different vaccines that were ready within a single year. You can see this, maybe you can just see the bar on the end there. It really wasn't clear beforehand that this was actually possible for the world to do. Vaccines are still extremely important in global biodefense, providing an eventual way out for pandemics like COVID, whose high R-naught, so the kind of high infectivity, means that they can't be suppressed by behavioral changes alone. Other interventions buy us time to get the vaccines. And if we can bring that time sooner, like how long we have to wait it out, it also makes that task of surviving until the vaccines that much easier. A fourth and final implication of COVID concerns gain-of-function research. This is the kind of research where scientists make a more deadly or more transmissible version of an existing pathogen. And it's one of the sources of extreme pandemics that I was most concerned about in The Precipice. While the scientists behind gain-of-function research are well-meaning, the track record of pathogens escaping their labs is much worse than most people realize. Now, with COVID, we had the bizarre situation where the biggest global disaster since World War II was very plausibly caused by a lab escape from well-meaning but risky lines of research on bat coronaviruses. Credible investigations of COVID origins are about evenly split on the matter. It's entirely possible that the actions of people at one particular lab may have killed more than 25 million people across the globe. Yet the response is often one of indifference, that it doesn't really matter, as it's in the past and we can't change it. I'm still genuinely surprised by this. I actually don't understand this. I'd like to think that if someone in a US lab may or may not be responsible for the deaths of millions of people, that it would be the trial of the century. Clearly, the story got caught up in a political culture war, as well as the mistrust between two great powers. Though I'd have actually have thought that these things would make it even more visible and charged as an issue. But people don't seem to mind, and gain-of-function research is carrying on more or less the way that it did before. Moving on from COVID, there have been recent developments in three different protective technologies that I'm really excited about and didn't cover in the book. The first is metagenomic sequencing. This is a technology that can take a sample from a patient or from the environment and sequence all the DNA and RNA within it from every different organism, matching them against a database of known organisms. An example of a practical deployment would be to use it for diagnostic conundrums. So if a doctor can't work out why a patient that's come to their hospital is so sick, they can take a sample and send it to a central lab for this metagenomic sequencing. If China had had this technology in 2019, then they would have known before the year was out that there was a novel pathogen whose closest match was SARS, but which had substantial changes from SARS. It wasn't SARS itself, or SARS-1, I guess, as we now call that. Given China's history with SARS and how seriously they were taking it, they would have acted very quickly to stop this. There are also potential use cases where a sample is taken from the environment. So for example, from wastewater from a city or an airport air conditioning system. Novel pandemics could potentially be detected even before symptoms manifest in the population by the signature of exponential growth over time of a novel sequence within that, that sample. The second of these technologies is I guess, a cluster of things around improving air quality. A big lesson from the pandemic is that epidemiology was underestimating the potential for airborne transmission of disease. This was thought to be extremely unusual, with almost no viruses being spread by this mechanism, and now it's seen as much more possible for a wider range of viruses. This opens the possibility for a revolution in public health. Just as there were tremendous gains in the 19th century, when water-based transmission was understood and the importance of clean water was discovered, so there might be tremendous gains from clean air. A big surprise of the pandemic was how little transmission occurred on planes, even when there was an infected person sitting near you. A lot of this was due to the impressive air conditioning and filtration that modern planes have. We could upgrade our buildings to include such systems. And there have been substantial advances in germicidal UV light, including the new UVC band, that may have a very good trade-off in its ability to kill germs without damaging human skin or eyes. There are a couple of different pathways to protection using these technologies. We could upgrade our shared buildings, such as offices and schools, airports, to use these all of the time. This would limit transmission of viruses, even in the first days before we've become aware of an outbreak, slowing it down, giving more time to react. And it would have substantial immediate benefits in preventing the spread of cold and flus. It could be just worthwhile for office buildings to do this just on those grounds alone. And during a pandemic, we could scale up the deployments to many more locations. So some key features that these technologies have are that they can deal with a wide range of pathogens, including novel ones, whether natural or engineered. They even help with stealth pathogens before they produce symptoms. They require little pro-social behavior change from the public, which we know was only doable for so long. And they have big spillover benefits for helping fight everyday infectious disease like the flu. And research on them, this is in some ways one of the most important, research on them isn't dual use. they systematically help defense rather than offense, making it a good target for funding or work by people who really care about protecting the future. Finally, when it comes to pandemics, there's the role of AI on pandemic risk. Biology is probably the science that's benefited the most from AI so far. For example, when I wrote The Precipice, biologists had determined the structure of about 50,000 different proteins, how they fold up in order to make useful molecules for the body. Then DeepMind's AlphaFold applied AI to solve the protein folding problem and has used it to find and publish the structure of 200 million proteins. There's more than 1,000 known examples now for every one that was known 4 years ago. This example doesn't have any direct effect on existential risk, but a lot of biology does come with risks. And rapidly accelerating biological capabilities across the board may open up new risks at a faster rate, giving us less time to anticipate and respond to them. A very recent avenue where AI might contribute to a pandemic risk is through language models like ChatGPT, making it easier for bad actors to learn how to engineer and deploy novel pathogens to create catastrophic pandemics. This isn't a qualitative change in the risk of engineered pandemics, as there's already a strong process of democratization of biotechnology, with the latest breakthroughs and techniques being rapidly replicable by people with fewer skills and less well-resourced labs. Ultimately, very few people want to deploy catastrophic bioweapons, but as the pool of people who could do so expands, the chance that it contains someone with these rare motivations grows. AI language models are pushing this democratization further and faster. And unless these abilities are removed from future AI systems, they will indeed increase the risk from bioterrorism. Which brings us at last to AI risk. So much has happened in AI over the last 5 years that it's hard to even begin to summarize it. But I want to zoom in on three things that I think are really especially important. First, there is the shift from reinforcement learning agents to language models. So 5 years ago, if you cast your mind back, the leading work on artificial general intelligence was game-playing agents trained with deep reinforcement learning, deep RL. Systems like AlphaGo, AlphaZero, AlphaStar, and OpenAI 5. These are systems that are trained to take actions in a virtual world which outmaneuver an adversary, pushing inexorably towards victory no matter how the opponent tries to stop them. And they all created AI agents which could outplay the best humans at these wide variety of games. Now the cutting edge is generative AI, systems that generate images, videos, and especially text. These new systems are not inherently agents. This is a big deal. So the classical threat scenario of Yudkowsky and Bostrom, the one that I focus on in my section in The Precipice, doesn't directly apply to them. And it does look like people will be able to make powerful agents out of these language models. So it's not completely removing agents from the picture. But this is a form of artificial general intelligence, or at least a pathway to it, suggesting a form of it, that doesn't have to be in agent form. It was even unclear whether that was even conceptually possible 5 years ago. And so it may be possible for the first labs to make aligned non-agent AGI systems to help with safety measures that could then be applied to make AI agents safe. Or it could be possible for national or international governance to outlaw advanced AI agents while still benefiting from advanced non-agent systems. As Stuart Russell predicted, these new AI systems have read vast amounts of human writing, something like 1 trillion words of text. All of Wikipedia, novels and textbooks, vast parts of the internet. it's probably read more academic ethics than I have. And almost all of fiction is nothing but humans doing things to other humans combined with judgments about those actions. So it had, you know, these leading models would have more training data on ethics and human values than any of us have access to over our lives. And this is in big contrast to the game-playing systems, which knew nothing of human values, and where it was unclear how to even ever teach them about such values. So the challenge is no longer in getting them enough information about ethics and human values. The challenge very clearly now is about making them care, to be actually motivated by these things. But that's still substantial progress. Now, because this was a form of supervised learning as opposed to reinforcement learning, and that it used this vast amount of training data, it's not too far away from all text ever written and, you know, all human knowledge that has been written down or something like that. So it's quite remarkable. It may not know all human knowledge. It doesn't know how to ride a bicycle or lots of things that are more about know-how rather than things that can be written and described clearly. But it's still a vast amount of knowledge. And the, let's see. And this allowed this huge amount of knowledge ingesting this has allowed a very rapid improvement of capabilities. But it's not quite the general purpose acceleration of capabilities that people like Yudkowsky have been predicting. He predicted that accelerating AI capabilities would blast through the relatively narrow range of human abilities because there's nothing special about those levels. And because it would rise so fast, it would pass through in a very short amount of time, giving very little time to react and respond for society. So, language models have been growing more capable even faster than this, right? We've seen a kind of acceleration in the speed of the gain of capabilities. You could think of it like this here. But with them, in this case, with language models, there is something special about the human range of capabilities. And that makes a big difference, because that's the level of all the text that they've been trained on, right? They're kind of trying to replicate the types of responses that humans give to things, and they're, in doing so, they've got access to all of the knowledge that humans have created, not some other civilization. Their capabilities are being pulled rapidly upwards towards the human level as they train on all our writings, but they may also plateau at that point. So they may actually be pulled kind of into this zone, leaving a much longer period of time within the human range. And this could be some good news. Now, in some sense, even if you trained a language model, you know, you just kept training it forever, more and more compute, more and more data, it may still exceed human capabilities in certain senses. For example, it could know more topics simultaneously than any particular human could, and be faster at writing or you know, responding about these topics. But without some new approach, they might not exceed the best humans in each area, and they might not lead to something that we really felt was qualitatively different to human intelligence. Now, even if people then move to some new kinds of training to keep on advancing beyond the human level, maybe they take these systems that have been trained in this way, and then they go back and apply reinforcement learning or some other technique to try to keep pulling them past. Even if they do that, this might return to the slower speeds of improvement that we'd seen previously and put a kind of kink into the learning curve. So I think that this hasn't really been fully recognized, that while things are going faster at the moment, it's a process that actually is less open-ended. Finally, because these language models rely on truly vast amounts of compute in order to scale them, running an AGI lab is no longer possible as a nonprofit. One needs to have these partnerships with very profitable major tech companies. And it's no longer possible as a side project for a rich company. The once quite academic and cautious AGI labs have become dependent on vast amounts of compute from their corporate partners. And these corporate partners want rapid productization and more control over their agenda in return. And the AGI labs often need to productize things on their own in order to pay their corporate partners for this compute. Another big change in AI risk that's closely related to that last point comes from the increased racing towards AI. We'd long been aware of the possibilities and danger of racing, that it would lead to cutting corners in safety in an attempt to get advanced AGI before anyone else does. The first few years after writing The Precipice saw substantial racing between OpenAI and DeepMind, with Anthropic also joining the fray. Then in 2023, something new happened. It became not just a race between these labs, but a race between the largest companies on Earth. Microsoft tried to capitalize on its prescient investments in OpenAI, seizing what they thought as the moment of its largest lead in AI, to try for Google's crown jewel of search. They put out a powerful but badly misaligned system that gave the world its first example of an AI system that turned on its own users. I'm talking of the new Bing, or as it sometimes called itself, Sydney. Some of the most extreme examples that happened included threatening revenge on a journalist from the Associated Press because he had written a negative story about it, which it couldn't believe was true, and so it assumed he must be lying and an enemy. And it even threatened to kill an AI ethics researcher. He recorded that on his phone, handheld, and then watched as it deleted the threats and replaced them with a kind of anodyne joke, because there was a second system designed to catch if it was behaving this badly and try to backtrack it. Now, this system still, it wasn't really an agent, and it wasn't really trying to get vengeance on people. It was more that it was simulating a persona who acted like that. But it was still systematically performing behaviors that, if done by humans, would be threats of vengeance. And this could still have a chilling effect. People who wrote negative things about it, if someone else tried to search for them using the search engine, it could see the negative things they'd written and gets back into one of these cycles where it assumed that that person was lying about it and needed to be defamed. Microsoft managed to tamp down these behaviors quite quickly, especially just by not letting your conversation go more than a few steps long. And it ended up with a system that did pose a real challenge for Google on its crown jewel of search. Google responded by merging its brain and DeepMind labs into a single large lab and to make them much more focused on building ever larger language models and immediately deploying them in products. I'm really worried that this new race between big tech companies, companies that while connected to the labs, that they don't themselves really get the risks from advanced AI in the same way that the labs do. I'm worried that this will push the labs into riskier deployments, that it will lead to these companies pushing back against helpful regulation, which could be otherwise try to cool this race, and to make it harder for the labs to pull the emergency brake if they think that their systems are becoming too dangerous and shouldn't be deployed. Finally, the last 16 months has seen dramatic changes in public and government interest around AI and AI risk in particular. By the time I wrote The Precipice, there was certainly already public interest in the rise of AI, especially the AlphaGo victory over Lee Sedol. And the US government was making noises about a possible race with China on AI, but without much action to show for it at that point. And this really started to change in October 2022, when the US government introduced a raft of export controls on computer chip technologies to keep the most advanced AI chips out of China and to delay China developing an AI chip industry of its own. This was a major sign of serious intent to control international access to the compute needed for advanced AI development. Then, a month later, saw the release of ChatGPT, followed by Bing and GPT-4 in early 2023. Public access to such advanced systems led to a rapid rise in public awareness of how much AI had progressed and increased the public concern about its risks. In May 2023, Jeffrey Hinton and Joshua Bengio, two of the founders of deep learning itself, both came out expressing deep concern about what they had created and advocated for governments to respond to the existential risks from AI. Later that month, they joined a host of other eminent people in AI in signing a succinct public statement that addressing the risk of human extinction from AI should be treated as a global priority. This was swiftly followed by a similar statement by the elders, a group of former world leaders, including a former UN Secretary General, a WHO Director General, and presidents and prime ministers of Ireland, Norway, Mongolia, Mexico, Chile, and more, with multiple Nobel Peace Prizes between them. They agreed that without proper global regulation, the extraordinary rate of technological progress with AI poses an existential threat to humanity. Existential risk from AI had finally gone from a speculative academic concern to a major new topic in global governance. Then in October and November, there was another flurry of activity by the US and the UK governments. Biden signed an executive order aimed at the safety of frontier AI systems. The UK convened the first of an ongoing series of international meetings on the international AI governance with an explicit focus on existential risk from AI. They even corrected the media who were saying, is this going to be mainly about questions of bias and fairness within AI? And they said, no, it's mainly on the existential risk from AI. 28 countries and the EU signed the Bletchley Declaration. Then the US and UK each launched their own national AI safety institutes. All told, this was an amazing shift in the Overton window in just 16 months. While there is by no means universal agreement, the idea that existential risk from AI is a major global priority is now a respected standard position by many leaders in AI and global politics, as is the need for national and international regulation of some sort of frontier AI. The effects on existential risk of all of this are complex. The shift to language models has had quite mixed effects. The racing is bad, the improved governance is good, and the overall picture is mixed. In the precipice, I gave my best guess probabilities for the existential risk over the next 100 years in each of these areas. These were 1 in 1,000 for climate and nuclear, 1 in 30 for pandemics, and 1 in 10 for unaligned AI. You're probably all wondering how all of this affects those numbers and what my new numbers are. But as you may have noticed, all of those numbers I gave are rounded off, usually to within a factor of 10, and none of them have moved that far to round off to a totally different number of digits. But I can say that in my view, climate risk is a bit better. The risk of existential risk from climate, that is, has improved. The existential risk from nuclear is up, unfortunately. And the story from pandemics and AI is mixed. Lots of changes, but no clear direction for the overall risk, in my view. Now, I want to close by saying just a few words about how the world has been reacting to existential risk as a whole. In the precipice, I presented the idea of what I call existential security. So this is a hypothetical future state of the world where existential risk is low and it's kept low, where we've put out the current fires and put in place the mechanisms to ensure that fire no longer poses a substantial threat. We're mainly still in the putting out fires stage at the moment, dealing with the challenges that have been thrust upon us. And that's currently the most urgent challenge we face. But existential security also includes the work to establish the norms and the institutions to make sure that things never get as out of control again as they are this century. Establishing the moral seriousness of existential risk, establishing the international norms, then international treaties, and then governance for tackling existential risk, no matter what form it takes. And this isn't going to be quick, but over a timescale of decades, I think there could be substantial progress. I mean, think now about how much has changed in half a decade. And making sure that that process succeeds over the coming decades is crucial if the gains that we make from fighting the current fires are to last. I think things here are moving in the right direction. The UN has started to explicitly focus on existential risks as a major global priority in some of their work. The elders have structured their whole agenda, actually, around fighting existential risks. One British Prime Minister quoted the precipice in a speech to the UN, and another had a whole major summit around existential risk from AI. The world is beginning to take security from existential risks seriously, and that's a very positive development. Thank you.